Hello and welcome to Talking Finance, and it's the day before the budget. I'm Alan Kohler. Well, this week on the show, we've got Paul Bloxham, Chief Economist at HSBC. He's the Chief Economist for Australia, New Zealand and Global Commodities. He's going to tell us about the budget and what to expect from interest rates. Also, Stephen Smith, partner at Deloitte Access Economics, talking about their recent business outlook, and he's giving us a bit of a extra look at economics. James Gerrish, Portfolio Manager of Shaw & Partners and author of Market Matters, takes us through what's going on in the markets, and Professor Mark Kenny from the Australian Studies Institute at the Australian National University talks to us about the politics of the budget and politics generally. And, well, there's so much happening at the moment that, you can't afford to miss today's Talking Finance. And now here's Paul Bloxham, Chief Economist at HSBC. Paul, what do you think the CPI will show on Wednesday when it comes out?
Look, we're pitching for the CPI being quite high. We think that the headline rate might be a bit over 7%. We've got a 7.3% year-on-year penciled in. And if you look at the core measures, which is, of course, the main thing that the RBA focuses on, we think it's going to pick up again and be running it at 5.5%. And that would be a pretty hefty pace of momentum in the inflation story. We think the monthly figures are starting to show some signs that inflation is sort of roughly peaking, that's where we're at. But on the quarterly figures, we think it's still going to be a pretty elevated in inflation number.
Do you think the Reserve Bank will come to regret slowing down the pace of its rate hikes?
That's a good question, and it's still a bit of an open one. But my view is that, you know, the RBA has gone really hard. Interest rates have risen a long way, really, really rapidly. It's very difficult to assess exactly how much impact they've had on the economy yet, because as is well understood, monetary policy operates with big, long lags. You lift interest rates, it takes months and months for you to see the full impact, and probably we won't see the full impact of what they've already done until around the turn of this year or even into early 2023. So I think that's why they've slowed down. Inflation is still high, but the rules of thumb that I'm using for thinking about the way the RBA is going to do this is that they would pivot, which they have. Obviously, they've slowed down to moving in a 25 basis point increment in October after they were convinced that inflation was at its peak and just about to start slowing a bit. And then they will stop lifting interest rates, in my view at least, when the unemployment rate starts to rise, when the labor market softens up. The labor market's obviously super tight right now. But there are some forces at work here that might see the unemployment rate start to rise in the coming months, in our view. And one of them is a slower economy, higher interest rates and that effect. And the other, of course, is now that the borders reopened, we're seeing quite a strong influx of migrants. So you know, there are two prongs, I think, to the way we should think about what the RBA will do next and why they've done what they've done so far. So I don't think we're going to see the RBA going back to 50 basis point increments again.
But where do you think the RBA cash rate will end up?
Well, on that forecast, and again, there's a lot of uncertainty around that, I think the RBA does another two hikes of 25 basis points, one in November and another in December. And by the time they reconvene in early February next year, my expectation is the unemployment rate will have passed its trough, will be starting to edge higher. The global economy will have slowed down quite a lot. And we'll see some really clear evidence that the interest rate rises that the RBA has already delivered are starting to slow down growth in a tangible way in Australia. And that, in my view, will mean that the RBA decides to pause, sit still at the 3.1% they'll have gotten to by December. And through next year, I've got them in holding on that 3.1%. So I've got them pausing at 3.1. That's where I think the cash rate will steady for a period.
And hold next year. I mean, do you think, you don't think that there's a likelihood that rates will start to be cut next year as inflation falls?
I don't think so. And the reason is this, the rationale is this, is that although inflation we do think will come down from the very high rates that it's at, and obviously we're talking about the idea that it's going to be 7 point something in the third quarter this week when we get the print, we think it's going to take quite some time for it to come all the way back to the Reserve Bank's 2-3% target. And given that it's still going to be above target, I think while it's above target, it's unlikely the RBA is going to want to cut interest rates. And so we have them on hold in a sustained way. The other thing we've got to keep in mind is it's not just a local story. It's not just an Australia story. There's a global narrative here as well. Inflation is higher in a lot of the Western countries. It's higher in Europe. It's higher in the UK. It's higher in the US. And in those countries, I think central banks have got more to do in terms of lifting interest rates. And it's going to be harder for them to get inflation back to their targets. So they will maintain higher interest rates. Now, if they maintain higher interest rates, it does have a bearing on the way the RBA might think about things. So no, I don't think we should expect that having lifted interest rates, and we think there's a further couple of hikes to come, that the RBA is going to be cutting interest rates anytime soon. I think that's going to be something much further out in the distance than the next year.
The other thing that's happening this week, of course, is the budget tomorrow. What are you expecting to see in that?
Look, we've been describing it as a true mini budget. We don't think there's going to be actually that much that's announced. There isn't a lot of room to maneuver at the moment. If the government were to deliver a lot more spending, that would just contribute more to the inflation problem that we've got in Australia. Demand is running ahead of supply, and they just add to that. So they know that if they were to lift interest, they were to do a lot of government spending, it might drive the RBA to have to lift interest rates even more. So that limits the extent to which they can do that. And they also know that the global economy is slowing down and that the local economy is slowing down as well because interest rates are rising. So there's just not a lot of room to maneuver. So I guess the main features are likely to be, one, they're going to revise down the growth forecast. They've already really told us that. Two, they're going to forecast that inflation stays elevated for quite some time, as I've kind of already described in the context of the RBA. And although I think they're going to announce a few various measures of spending, things like on childcare and paid parental leave, the sorts of elements that they took to the election, I really don't think there's going to be that much spending announced. And I don't think there are going to be sort of broader-based reforms announced either. So it's sort of a mark-to-market set out where we stand in the economy, but it's, you know, a true mini-budget in a way, not going to have a lot of headline features.
Do you think GDP growth will go negative at all?
No, we've got growth slowing down, but not actually contracting. That's our central case at the moment. And I think there are two key narratives we've got in mind. And by the way, that's unusual globally, because we have in mind that Europe is already tipping into a recession, the UK as well. I think the US has got a lot of challenges in terms of its growth story as well. So the global economy has got a pretty decent slowdown going on and running into next year. So it'd be unusual for Australia to have a soft landing relative to that story. But we've got sort of two key things. One is, although inflation has picked up in Australia, and we've talked about that already, it hasn't really gotten through to the wage setting process in the same sort of way as it has elsewhere. So it's not really embedded itself here in Australia yet. It's come later and it's not as quickly gotten into wages. So we don't think the RBA is going to have to go as hard as we think some of the other central banks are. So that's a positive. And then the other thing we've got to keep in mind is the world at the moment is short on energy, and Australia is a large energy exporter. We're the second largest exporter of liquefied natural gas and the second largest exporter of thermal coal. And so although the global economy is going into a downturn, as I'm describing, demand for energy is set to remain fairly solid, and that should continue to provide an income stream and a boost for Australia in a relative sense. So now we've got growth slowing down next year, from about 4% this year to a little under 2% next year, but we don't actually have it contracting outright. Our central case is that the RBA is able to track the narrow pathway that they've described and deliver a soft landing for the economy. The final caveat would be, with that global backdrop, we do have to keep in mind that the risks to that forecast are tilted to the downside. There's no sort of, I don't think there's any way of getting around that. There are downside risks to the growth forecast, but we think a soft landing is the likely central case at this stage.
Thanks very much, Paul.
Thanks, Alan.
And now here's Stephen Smith, partner at Deloitte Access Economics. Stephen, what do you think the main challenges for the government are? I mean, obviously inflation's going to keep rising, but how far do you think it's going to go?
Well, we think that the government is broadly right in thinking about the next sort of 3 to 6 months being the peak in inflation. We see headline CPI growth of close to 7% through this financial year and then falling thereafter. That's a little bit lower than what the government is expecting. But yeah, that's certainly one of the big challenges that they're facing at the moment. But the global backdrop is deteriorating a lot as well. And so, you know, navigating that and preparing a budget in that sort of complex sort of global environment is, that's the big risk at the moment.
And how many rate hikes do you expect to see now from here?
We think there'll only be two more, so about another 50, possibly 75 basis points up from here, which is certainly a lot lower than what others are anticipating. But we think that the challenge for the RBA will be that whilst inflation still elevated, economic growth starting to slow quite quickly over the next 12 months, and so we think that. They should certainly be pausing and letting the rate hikes that they've already done kind of have the effect on slowing the economy and therefore letting inflation come down over time.
There was a really interesting graph in your business outlook that you released last week showing that retail spending is decoupled from consumer sentiment, like quite dramatically. Why is that, do you think?
It's been really one of the most fascinating elements of the economy coming out of COVID, where households have really consumer spending, retail spending has really been very resilient in the face of what we think are some pretty dramatic global conditions and rising inflation and rising interest rates. There's still a little bit of a hangover of COVID in terms of this war chest that's been much talked about in terms of consumers saving during COVID and then running down some of that spending. But absolutely, there's this yawning gap between where consumer sentiment would think that retail spending should be and where retail actually has been. We think that's only really going to close in one way, and that is spending coming back as opposed to sentiment picking up. But it's really the hangover from COVID that's causing that, and we think it's temporary.
And it's probably got a bit to do with house prices, doesn't it? I mean, sentiment is affected by house prices, but perhaps people are still spending in the shops.
Yeah, I mean, it's quite extraordinary with the pace of interest rates that we've had. I mean, this has been the quickest tightening cycle that we've seen in a very long period of time. House prices starting to come off. The global backdrop, what's been happening in the US and the UK and Europe, is certainly weighing on sentiment as well to some extent. But consumers have proved pretty resilient in the in the last 12 months or so. This bounce back from the Delta lockdown that we had towards the end of 2021, has been very, very strong. And we just don't think that can last. At some point, that consumer war chest will run out or run low, and sentiment will start to sort of weigh on spending.
And the other thing is the Australian dollar. What do you expect to see out of that over the next 12 months?
Definitely some weakness in the Australian dollar over the next 12 months. We think it will stay above 60 cents at this stage, but clearly there's a risk that it will go lower. The two big drivers for the Australian dollar, of course, are commodity prices and also the differential in interest rates between Australia and the US, if we're talking about the US dollar exchange rate. Commodity prices have been very high, but we think we'll come off. They'll have to come off over the medium term, and so the pace of interest rate hikes in the US we think will continue to outstrip that in Australia. So that's more downward pressure on the dollar. As I say, I think we are expecting relative to the US to stay above 60 cents. Certainly weakness over the next 12 months.
Yeah, right. And what about the budget tomorrow? What are you expecting to see out of that?
It's a fascinating position where the budget is at the moment. It's both not in a great position itself, but it's also the envy of most governments around the world, which is a really odd place. We think that there will be some large upgrades to revenue. We had our budget monitor out a couple of weeks ago, where we were suggesting about $114 billion in additional revenue over the next 4 years, about $80 billion of that due to company tax. But we'll also be seeing big increases in spending as well. And so, this structural budget deficit that the Treasurer has been talking about is absolutely real. And you know, we think you know, the budget needs more revenue. We won't see a lot in this particular budget tomorrow night, but in terms of sort of big policy announcements or sort of big decisions to be made, but certainly in the May budget and beyond, you know, the government's going to have to do something to get the budget back on a better structural footing. So,
do you think they even can close the structural budget deficit?
It's going to take a lot of hard work. It's you know, and some really difficult, unpopular decisions. You know, this has been a long time coming, and you know, the public is now, not just in Australia but around the world, I think, more used to governments sort of stepping in and spending more and you know, coming to the rescue in times of economic downturn. That's only possible when the budget's in a decent position. And you know, there's some very large spending programs where the spending is growing very rapidly, and we just simply don't have the tax system set up in a way that can keep pace. And so we need both more revenue and less spending. And you know, by definition, that those are two unpopular things.
What do you think the structural budget deficit is?
We think it's about 40 to 50 billion. And so, you know, that's pretty sizable, of course. And you know, a lot's been spoken about in terms of the NDIS, but there's you know, other sort of very large spending coming down the pipe, including defence. You know, that's, you know, the draw on public finances over the next decade or two, you know, will be extraordinary. And you know, there's two issues with that. One is, you know, we just don't have the tax settings right in Australia in terms of the tax mix and our ability to raise revenue in the most efficient way. The other problem, of course, is just simply the pace of that spending coming from a position where, you know, we've got, you know, after COVID, we've got relatively high levels of net debt, at least historically for Australian standards. And so that just makes for a tricky time for governments, I think, trying to wean Australians off government as the source of the rescue.
Thanks very much, Stephen.
Thanks, Alan.
And now here's James Gerrish, Portfolio Manager at Shore & Partners and author of the newsletter Market Matters. James, a bit of news out of the Federal Reserve on Friday that maybe they're going to have a pivot. The market's been waiting for a pivot, and maybe it's going to get one.
It's been elusive for a while, Alan, and I think whether or not it would have come from the Fed, but it was reported in the Wall Street Journal, just the fact that they're 75 basis points is likely in early November when they have their next FOMC meeting, but that could then signal a pivot on the table. And standing back and seeing what all these aggressive rate hikes have meant for the underlying economy, and sort of like taking a wait and see sort of approach. So anyway, time will tell. But normally they leak things through the through the media, so the market's well informed ahead of time. So perhaps that's what's happened.
And the bond market has been a bit upset about what's been going on in the UK. Do you think that's likely to settle down after they choose a new PM?
Well, it's understandable. If you're what's happened in the UK is simply extraordinary. So, and I think, you know, bond markets price in risk, and when things like that play out, then obviously risk goes up, and it has a massive influence on the appetite to hold UK debt. I mean, any more level-headedness, more stability out of the UK is going to be a positive. I think the world is more focused on what's happening in terms of US bond markets. So, they've continued to, last week, I mean, they continued to be, yields continued to go up. So you've got the US 10-year at 4.21%. I'd note just on the back of what was leaked from the Wall Street Journal, the 2 years were down 14 basis points. So that's more of the 2 years, the shorter end of the curve is more susceptible to Interest rate, near-term interest rate expectations. So they're back down at 4.47%. So that's probably the one you look at if you're thinking about or wanting an indication on sort of near-term interest rates.
So if the Fed pivots or at least indicates in November at the same time as hiking rates by 75 points, do you think that if they indicate that, you know, things are maybe going to slow down now, that we may have maybe seen the bottom of the market?
Yeah, I think that's a really strong case to argue that. I mean, if I look at investor positioning, so the latest Bank of America Merrill Lynch investor survey was out last week. You look at, you know, how fund managers are positioned, they're the most bearish they have been in a very long time. Cash levels are at, average cash levels are at 6.8%, I think, which is the highest in 20 years. 50% of respondents said that they were underweight equities. So when you think about that, everyone is bearish, and for good reason in terms of the economic challenges that are playing out. But then if you get less bad news, if you get some type of change in expectations around interest rates, etc., then a lot of fund managers have got to up-spec their allocations to equities, and you can get aggressive rallies on the back of that. And I think that will happen. We saw it on a leaked bit of information around a potential pivot, got the Dow up nearly 2.5% on Friday. So I absolutely think the market is positioned to negatively, and any surprise on the upside will be met with, really strong buying.
And to what extent will the US earnings season, which is obviously in full swing, impact that? I mean, obviously the market is kind of interested or thinking about what the earnings are going to do. Do you think the market is positioned sufficiently for what's likely to happen with earnings?
Yeah, so in terms of what this quarter, earnings are up 3.1% so far. So we've got about 30% of the S&P 500 companies reporting this week. So that'll change. In the next 12 months going into this earnings season, analysts expected growth of 7.8%. Because of the guidance that's been issued so far, growth in earnings are likely to be 7.2%. But if you think about, everyone's saying we're going to go into recession and the US is, definitely going to go into recession. Earnings growing at 7.2% is probably not recessionary. So there is still more earnings downgrades to come if the recessionary outcome plays out. So probably not. So the market's still, drinking the Kool-Aid. But for now, the earnings season has been as good as it always is in the US. I mean, they always under-promise and over-deliver. So far, we've had 73-74% of companies beat expectations. So pretty much on track as pretty much in line with historical averages. So there hasn't been anything from an earnings front that's been, alarming. So that's why, the market to me is probably susceptible to an upside surprise.
Thanks very much, James.
Thanks, Alan.
And now on politics, here's Professor Mark Kenny from the Australian Studies Institute at ANU. Well, Mark, what's the politics of the budget tomorrow?
Well, the politics of this budget are, in one sense, quite simple, and another sense, in the detailed sense, I guess, quite complicated. I mean, at one level, the government has a strong mandate. This is its first budget. Governments tend to get first budgets right. They can't win an election with their first budget. They can lose one. So there is the potential for, getting ahead of yourself and making the sorts of mistakes that we saw Joe Hockey and Tony Abbott make back in 2014 with their first budget, which really framed the government at the time's fortunes and probably sealed the end of Abbott's leadership and took out Hockey as well. I don't think this government's going to succumb to any of those kinds of temptations, but it's such a complicated picture, as you know, economically speaking, that the political options for them are quite limited. So, getting into the sort of rorts and waste, as the government likes to describe it, all the discretionary funds, sports rorts and things like that that we heard so much about in the last term, getting into those things will be a feature. But of course, even when they're aggregated together, they don't necessarily amount to a huge amount in terms of structural changes to the budget. It's really the conditions that the government faces now, which are so different from, I guess, the political narrative that that Labor, you know, told, sort of designed for the electorate, you know, before it was elected. It's really sort of trying to reconcile those complicated circumstances with, you know, with the politics of what it set up.
So Jim Chalmers has been talking about it as a bread and butter budget, and I think he's been saying that it's going to be about reconciliation of their promises, $18 billion worth of promises. So, look, that's probably going to be it, isn't it? I mean, they're just going to do that and move along.
Well, I suppose so. I mean, at one level, this budget, some people think this budget might not even be fully necessary. And when you look at the rationale for it, it's the second budget in 2022. That's pretty uncommon. And it's being done so that the government can actually give effect to a number of those things that it made promises about, that it, made commitments to the electorate to get on top of in terms of waste and so forth. So it's... It makes sense for the government to be doing this at the moment, but whether it's going to, you know, dramatically change either the economic or the political calculus, I guess remains to be seen. The real problem for the government here is, and it's a problem facing all governments, is that people are finding it increasingly hard to make ends meet. The answer to that normally, and the answer for the last government rather conveniently, was to be able to spend, to be able to put money in people's pockets, to be able to stimulate the economy to get things going. That is not open to this government now. This government needs to be operating with monetary policy in order to get on top of inflation. We know inflation is scheduled to go to or predicted to go to 7.75% by the end of this year. So the government can't be doing anything that is egregiously adding to demand and adding to inflation in that regard, and that limits its options politically as well. So there will be some new spending in the budget, but it's going to be very limited and very targeted and done with a great deal of reluctance, I think.
Just a question without notice, Mark. Are you seeing any weak links in the cabinet?
No, not that I can think of, but I just don't think this government's been stress tested yet, really. It's still in the honeymoon period. I think it's broadly understood that this is an extremely difficult time for any government. So I think voters are giving the government a fair amount of leeway at the moment. The last government left in very difficult circumstances, and there was that sort of amazing post-election vindication of the decision when it emerged that Scott Morrison had all these secret ministries and the like. So there's a fair amount of, I think, relief on the part of voters. And I think, broadly speaking, the new government is going about its job methodically, and that is what voters want to see.
I suppose there's nothing to that'll extend the honeymoon more than relief.
Yeah, that's true. And I think Anthony Albanese is an extremely experienced politician and parliamentarian. And a whole number of these front benches, these ministers, have been ministers before. It's actually, when you think about it, a party coming into office after 9 years, it's pretty strongly experienced in that regard. I can't remember what the number is, but I think it's about 15 of the current front benches are former ministers. You know, they've been ministers before. We saw Albanese before the election quite often through that whole period of opposition, you know, as his term as leader, mentioning people like Bob Hawke and even occasionally John Howard when he was trying to sort of give voters this sense that an incoming Labor government, were it elected, would be methodical, would restore cabinet process, would be collective in its decision making, and would not make sudden, you know, mercurial types of moves. And I think that is the way the government's going about its business at the moment. But some of its key promises are going to be very hard to deliver. It, for example, sold voters on the idea that it was going to get wages moving. Now, wages, as you know, the government says, are starting to move at the moment. But Jim Chalmers admits that we're not going to see real wage growth until 2024. So that's a long time, and some voters are probably going to mark the government down for that. But I think at the same time, there's also a fairly widespread understanding in the electorate that this is a very difficult constellation of circumstances to govern in, and what they're looking for is order and process, and that's what the government so far is delivering.
And the Reserve Bank is trying to make sure that wages don't move too much. So it's kind of, they've got to be careful, don't they?
They do. And that's the same Reserve Bank that not so long ago was handing out signals to workers to get a bit more bolster, get a bit more muscular, to demand wage increases and to try and get wages moving that way. But even that's changed a bit. Yes, we want to see wage growth, but we don't want to see so much wage growth that it becomes a further problem for inflation. And, you know, there's the government's problem as well. It wants to see the inflation brought down so that interest rates can come down and other things can be put on more orderly settings, but it can't hand out too much in the way of relief. Chalmers is talking about an extra $33 billion in spending on pensions and support through this period. So there's going to be considerable call on the budget still, and that's extra money going into the economy. And it just makes it even more, it puts more import on discipline for the way the government handles the rest of the budget.
Yeah. Good on you, Mark. Thank you.
Thanks, Alan. Cheers.
Hello, baby. Yeah, this is the Big Bopper speaking.
And, it happens to be the Big Bopper's birthday today. Now, you might not remember Big Bopper, but he was made famous by dying in the plane crash that killed Buddy Holly and Ritchie Valens so many years ago, and made famous by Donald McLean's song, The Day the Music Died, American Pie. Anyway, he was most famous for Chantilly Lace, which he would have sung 1,000 times, if not many more. But he died at the age of 28, unfortunately. So here he is. The Big Bopper with Chantilly Lace.
Make me spend my money, make me feel real loose, like a long neck goose, like a girl.
Oh, baby, that's what I like.
What's that, baby? But, oh, honey. But, oh, baby, you know. Chantilly Lace had a pretty face, had a ponytail hanging down.
That's it from me. Have a great week.